Hello, it is Ryan, and we could all use an extra bright spot in our day, couldn't we? Just to make up for things like sitting in traffic, doing the dishes, counting your steps, you know, all the mundane stuff. That is why I'm such a big fan of Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has all your favorite social casino style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere with daily bonuses. That should brighten your day a little. Actually, a lot. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com. That's ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Lucky Land Casino. Asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car before my kids' PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Okay, round two. Name something that's not boring.
A laundry? Ooh, a book club. Computer solitaire, huh?
Ah, oh, sorry. We were looking for Chumba Casino.
That's right. Chumbacasino.com has over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com.
No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Football Social Daily, your daily Premier League podcast.
Welcome to Thursday's Football Social Daily. This is your daily Premier League podcast, and it was a clean sweep for the English top flight in the Champions League last night, with both Liverpool and Manchester City winning their group games. Liverpool beat Atletico Madrid 2-0 in what Jurgen Klopp claimed was nearly the perfect performance. Man City were also victorious by a 4-1 scoreline against Belgian side Bruges. But Pep Guardiola wasn't so cheery in his post-match presser. The City boss came out swinging, and we'll talk about that on today's show. We'll also box off the other European fair taking place tonight, as David Moyes will take charge of his 1,000th game as a manager when West Ham travel to Genk in the Europa League. And how will the Antonio Conte era begin at Spurs in the maligned Europa Conference? And speaking of new managers, Newcastle United still haven't found a successor to Steve Bruce. We ask why, and whether the new ownership at St James's Park might be making a meandering mess of their managerial search. I'm Niall McCaughan. Welcome to Football Social Daily. Thanks for your company today. And joining me on the show, just behind Alan Kirbishley at a cool 33-1 to be the next Newcastle boss, we've got Marley Anderson. How you doing, Marley?
My odds are tumbling by the day after this absolute mess that's going on right now. I think my name's in the raffle for whoever gets the job next, so I've got as good a chance as any.
I love those good old school dad style jokes. When Portsmouth had about six players on their books and we were in administration, my dad always used to say to me, "You should take your boots, you might get a game." It's like, shut up, Dad. What are you talking about? And also joining us on Football Social Daily today, our resident Scot, Callum Tyler, whose country is in full-on green mode this week with private jets, diesel engines and beef on the menu as well. How are you doing, Callum?
I'm good, thanks. Scotland covering itself in glory this week, as usual.
Well, there's Europa League action as well for Scottish teams tonight. I think Rangers away in Denmark. But let's talk about the Premier League sides in Champions League action last night. We'll start with Liverpool 2, Atletico Madrid 0. Great result for Liverpool, beating the La Liga champions with a clean sheet as well. Qualifications now secured, Marley. And considering what we discussed last time these two sides played, and yesterday on the podcast previewing this game, we thought it might be a bit closer than what it was. 2-0 to Liverpool, and it was a pretty controlled performance, all things considered, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was. It was professional. It was brilliant from Liverpool, to be fair. They made Atletico look like the kind of cannon fodder you get in the Champions League group stages that you just expect to beat. I mean, they had 75% possession. Obviously, that's helped with Atletico going down to 10 men, but still... dominant, totally dominant. Could have had four or five and really, really put Atletico to the sword, really. But two's enough, you know, take your foot off the gas, look at the weekend now. And yeah, they were absolutely brilliant again.
Yeah, 100%. I thought that they, as you say, made Atletico look like they were at arm's reach the whole time. And Jurgen Klopp, after the game, nearly labelled it a perfect performance, Callum. And you know, after a 5-0 against Manchester United a couple of weeks ago, it felt almost as if this gave him equal amount of satisfaction. I don't know what your take is.
Yeah, Liverpool are pretty terrifying. Like the way they controlled that performance, the chances they created, like their ability. I just watched the highlights, to be honest, because I was watching the Bruges match, but their ability to create chances out of seemingly nothing, like they don't need to get anywhere near as close to the box as other teams do. They just seem to find that ball. Their crossing is like formidable. They've got that ability to just slide the ball into places and the striker's just there. It's a team that are clearly on song. Clearly, you know, all the cogs are meshed together nicely, and they are a pretty terrifying prospect, you have to say, and they were really impressive last night.
Yeah, 100%. And Liverpool are now qualified through to the next round of the Champions League, the knockout stages. And we know how good Liverpool are in the Champions League. They've obviously won it 6 times as recently as 2019. So certainly Jurgen Klopp will have one eye on this competition as well as the Premier League, you feel. You mentioned those chances in getting close to the penalty area, or the need not to, I suppose, when it comes to Liverpool. And Trent Alexander-Arnold was a key part of that last night, Marley. Some great balls into the box, assisting, I think, both goals, wasn't it, with some really incisive passing. Where do you think he sits in terms of the top fullbacks in the game right now? Is it more about the style of play in which he operates? Because when we're talking about fullbacks, if you're talking about a defensive right back, you probably put Aaron Wan-Bissaka up there as one of the best defensive fullbacks in the Premier League, at least. When it comes to Trent Alexander-Arnold, most of his key assets are going forward, aren't they?
Yeah, it all depends on the game and your system and the way you approach the game. Like last night, as I said before, they had 75% possession. In that system, he's one of the best in the world without a doubt, because no team sets up to mark your right back. Like they just he always gets forgotten about. He's always has the space in front of him to get the ball and to meander forward and be unmarked. Even if someone marks him, like it's a winger who doesn't defend, so he's got a natural advantage. You know, Atletico last night are worried about Jota, Salah, who's also on his wing, which helps massively because everyone's, you know, quaking in the boots about, oh, you know, how many can Salah score against us if we don't switch on? And the guy behind him is just as dangerous because when Salah goes inside, he goes outside, and you've got a double threat there all the time. His delivery is superb, his passing's incredible. And you know, his crossing, as you've seen last night, the cross for Jota's header was superb. It should have been defended better, to be honest. You know, you expect one of the best defensive teams in the world to react to a cross, which you always knew was coming in at that point. But it was that good, it took out the centre-back and even managed to bounce before Jota headed it in, which no cross should ever do, to be honest. No cross should ever bounce in your box. It should be met on the full by your centre-back, who's trying everything he can to head it away. But that is Trent's delivery. He's got that there. The second one is just as good. I'm not even sure if it was a shot. I don't actually... He's like good enough to disguise that as a shot, but mean it as a pass for Mane's sort of deflected tap-in type of thing. So yeah, it depends on your performance, because again, if you give away like 60% possession, you might struggle defensively because you can get at him. And, you know, I like him as a player, but he is defensively still not quite at the top of his... at the top of the game, and I don't think he ever will be, but that's the balance you have. You know, if you've got him in your team, if somebody gets at him really like a lot, you know, yes, he might be a weakness, but for what he gives you when you've got the ball, there aren't many better in the world.
Yeah, I remember when David Beckham was at the peak of his powers putting balls into the box, and obviously Manchester United back then, Callum, played a 2 up front, so he had sort of 2 strikers to aim for, and the idea was to try and score headers and sort of half volleys and that sort of thing. In terms of Trent Alexander-Arnold and even Kevin De Bruyne and these players now in the Premier League that we see with excellent delivery, it's almost more about putting the ball in a dangerous area of the pitch rather than trying to pick out a teammate. It's almost, well, if I put the ball in that spot, in that region, it causes more problems and it's up to the rest of my team to get into those positions rather than picking his head up, seeing a player in the box and going, I'm going to aim for him.
I think so. I think also the forwards that they're passing to are much more mobile than the ones that Beckham was trying to hit. So Beckham was probably trying to hit a striker that was just kind of standing around, whereas Trent's got at least 3 very quick, very tricky forwards that are sprinting into the right positions. And I think also the understanding of the game and where to be, and they always talk about how coaches like Klopp and Guardiola play the percentages, and they really concentrate on sort of managing the kind of the odds of, like, well, if you're in that 6 yard box this many times, you know, that'll have so many expected goals or whatever. And I think it probably makes Trent Alexander-Arnold's job very simple, which is just keep hitting that space again and again and again as many times as you can, and we'll just get there as often as we can. And then actually when it comes off, it looks like he's put it on a plate and he's kind of laser focused the pass straight to their boot. But I think it's a sign of how the game is coached and how these players have been taught to play, but also how they're just so consistent at doing their job right. But yeah, he's an absolutely phenomenal player.
I've seen people say, Marley, that Trent Alexander-Arnold could play as a central midfielder in the future due to the ability he's got on the ball and his passing range. But I have seen him play there before. I think for England, he's played as a central midfielder in a couple of games, and it's not really worked. And actually, his England involvement has been limited under Gareth Southgate recently. Do you think that it's a bit of a waste if he's not being utilised effectively? Because we've seen on a number of occasions over a number of years now just how good he can be.
Yeah, I think if you've got one of the best right backs in the world, why bother trying to turn him into a midfielder? You get more attention as a midfielder. I think he's easier to mark if you play him in like Liverpool's midfield three. He's got more people around him. Yes, he can play there, absolutely. He's good enough on the ball, but I'm always a fan of putting the strongest players in the stronger positions and building your squad around him. It's not like he's a player that can only play in certain systems. Like most systems use a right back or a right wing back. So he's always going to have somewhere in that team that he can make his own. I think the thing with England is just that there's that many right backs. He's trying to make the best out of them. And we've got less very, very good centre midfielders than we have very, very good right backs. So I think when Southgate did that, Klopp was fuming with him, and he was like, why would you play your best right back in centre midfield, and a bit critical of it, but you can understand why he did it. However, just play your square pegs in square holes. Don't try and move them around too much, even though he probably can do it. But in the same way that, you know, Andy Robertson could probably be a really good defensive midfielder because he's good at tackling and he's got loads of energy, but you wouldn't try and put him there because he's great at left back. And same goes with many, many other players as well. But for me, Trent is very, very good at right back. So keep playing him there. What's the issue?
Yeah, absolutely. And he was involved in Liverpool's goals last night as they beat Atletico by 2-0. Jurgen Klopp was pretty chipper after the game. Pep Guardiola wasn't so, despite the fact his Manchester City side beat Club Bruges by 4-1 at the Etihad last night. It's a good win for City. Just a point really needed now for them to qualify to the knockout stages. I think we should mention Joao Cancelo before we talk about Pep Guardiola, though, Callum. Unbelievable performance again. 3 assists in the game, a constant threat down the left-hand side, often pops up through the centre as well. He's proven to be a real star buy for Manchester City, isn't he?
Absolutely. And if I was on football Twitter with a player as my avatar, I would be saying how the biased Scouse media are just bigging up Trent when actually Cancelo is twice the player. Many tweets I have seen from Man City fans this morning. Cancelo, he was brilliant last night. He had a bit of a slow start to his City career. I think he kind of admitted himself. He struggled to adjust to Manchester life and also to the way that Guardiola wanted to play. But I mean, one of the things that Guardiola said in his presser afterwards was that he's in a good moment. He's an incredible player on his day, and he's brilliant. He's really, really dangerous. And I think the kind of marauding runs he does from wing back, I'm not sure he's quite the same sort of out and out hugging the touchline type player that Trent is. But his eye for a pass, the way that he can kind of actually cut inside sometimes as well, he can also play in midfield. He's a really versatile player. And last night he kind of showed everything that he could do, and he basically, I mean, 3 assists and a 4-1 win, he kind of single-handedly won that game for us almost.
Yeah, 100%. I thought he was excellent last night. You know, 3 assists out of the 4 goals, I think, speaks for itself. Also, Raheem Sterling scored last night, Marley, and we mentioned a couple of weeks ago, I think, in the reverse fixture when City won 5-1, that Raheem Sterling almost needed a good game, because the longer he goes without scoring and being involved and making a nuisance of himself, the more that criticism is going to be attracted to him. He did break his goal drought last night. He scored a goal. City fans will be hoping that that'll be the start of kind of a rejuvenation of form, because it's not been the easiest start to the season for him.
Yeah, it's It's not, but his talent never goes away, so you know it's there. It's not like he's, you know, fell off a cliff in terms of his talent and his form. Like, he's not been at his best, but I think that's more because there's other players playing well at Manchester City than him playing poorly. You know, Grealish has came in, obviously he's going to get games and time to settle in that team. Mahrez has never put a foot wrong for a couple of seasons now. And you've got others in there as well, you know, Jesus playing towards a wing, Foden playing across that front three. So it's not like he's just lost it. He's still quality. But it's nice to see him scoring last night. Obviously, it's just a tap in, but it'll do his confidence a world of good. And I wouldn't bet against Pep starting him in the derby. I think he's one of them big game players now. You see him for England. He turns up in the big games and he's proper up for it. And he's one of the guys who will like take a game by the scruff of its neck. And I just wonder if Guardiola's keeping him for the Manchester derby and maybe taking Jack Grealish out or something like that, but we'll have to wait and see. I might be completely wrong, probably am, but the point is Sterling's still quality, and if you've got that strength in depth, then you know you're a very scary proposition.
You should know by now, after 5 years, Marley, you can never second guess Pep Guardiola.
Well, that's why I said it. You know, people might go, he'll never do that, but then you'll get to the game and he'll be like, oh Christ, Sterling's playing left.
Zinchenko up front.
Yeah. Waiting for Edison up front at least once before he leaves Manchester City. What's your thoughts on that, the Raheem Sterling situation? I don't like to call it a situation. He's just a player who isn't in as good as form as he might like to be. What's your thoughts, Callum?
Yeah, it's like, you know, obviously I was pleased to see him score last night. He's long been one of my favourite players. I think it was good to get him back in the team, back scoring, especially because there's been sort of rumours flying around that he was away possibly to Arsenal or Newcastle or Europe somewhere. I don't think that's going to happen, certainly not in January. They seem to have quietened down a little bit, but I think it maybe took him a little while to get back into form and fitness after what was a huge summer for him. Not just physically, but I think also he was one of the leaders of that England team. He was one of the senior players. There was a lot on his shoulders and he didn't really get a break. And I think it was just a bit of a slow start. As Marley said, he's in a very competitive team with a whole bunch of players, some of whom came off a pretty long break, the likes of Mahrez. I can see it going both ways. I can see it being a bit stop-start, depending on the chances that Pep's going to give him. But I can equally see him going on a bit of a purple patch now, sort of into January in the new year. And, you know, I hope he does. And like you're saying, if you're Man United trying to plan for whether Sterling plays or Mahrez plays or someone else plays, Bernardo plays, like, it's kind of an impossible task to prepare for that. I mean, Ollie won't bother anyway, but you know, he's always going to be a danger and always a good man to have, whether he's on the bench or whether he's in the team.
As you say, the Manchester derby this weekend, it's promising to be a really exciting game. Finding it difficult at the moment to know exactly what you're going to get from Manchester United. Comfortable win over Tottenham, demolished by Liverpool, and a draw with Atalanta, which some suggested papered over the cracks. I think it's really difficult to tell what might be in store this weekend. But speaking ahead of this Club Brugge game, Pep Guardiola mentioned in that press conference before the game that this match against Brugge was more important than the Manchester derby. Now, I said this on yesterday's podcast and that maybe his comments might have been taken slightly out of context. I think his suggestion was that the group stages of the Champions League, you only get 6 games to qualify, whereas in the Premier League, he said that there are still 28 games left and it's still only another 3 points at the end of the day for Manchester City if they beat United at the weekend. But certainly in terms of a soundbite, it made for a good headline, didn't it? Pep Guardiola says Manchester United game is less important than Club Brugge game. Despite the fact that his side beat Club Brugge convincingly in the Champions League last night, you'd think he might be in a good mood after the game. Certainly wasn't the case. Have a listen to this.
The people taking the to me for the fact I said today is more important than United, and it was. Now, right now, the most important game ever is Man United. So maybe the people have the ability to think about for the next one, forgetting what you have to say. Maybe you interview right now, you're saying to me it's less important than the interview we're going to do next Friday to me. So I don't know. But for me, today was really important because in the Premier League, we have 28 games left. 28. And here, there are just 6 games to play, to qualify. It's just 3, now 2. And this, like Bruges, it was incredibly important. And the people say, no, Pep is a... No, it's not that. It's so important today. And we won it, and that's why we are in a good position. We need 1 point, 3 points to qualify. And in February, hopefully we can be in the last 16 with the best teams in Europe.
What do you make of that, Marley? Because I think he made his point pretty clear there in what he was saying. The most important game is the next game. And at that point in time, the next game was Club Brugge. It's an old manager cliche. And I guess Pep was at the end of his tether with it a little bit.
Yeah, it's nothing new, is it? You know, most managers do this, and Guardiola's did this for a couple of years, hasn't he? You know, the next game's the most important one, and he seems determined to mean that. Like, he wants everyone to get used to that. And I think with the way the media is around the world, but obviously especially in England, you know, if you say something's not as important as something else, you know, it's all it is clicks for them. You know, it's an easy soundbite. It's an easy headline to write that you almost imply that Pep doesn't think the derby is important. But any fan with half a brain knows where he's coming from on this. Like, everybody knows that he thinks that the next game is the most important game, because at the end of the day, you can only win your next game. You can only concentrate on your next game. You can't win the Man United game on a Wednesday night in the Champions League, because it doesn't happen until Saturday or Sunday. So it's just another example of it, and I think it's just got to him a little bit, and it's probably just got under his skin a little bit, and because it's probably like the 25th, 30th time this has happened, and that would start to annoy you after a while. So I completely understand where he's coming from.
Yeah, I can also understand why the fans are annoyed, though, because he didn't need to say that, did he? He didn't need to say this game is more important than the Manchester United game.
But he's always said that, though.
I don't know whether it's unfair for me to say that, because English is not his first language, and I think you need to be careful when you're criticising what people say when they're not natural or native English speakers. I think that's important to stress. But surely someone with the experience of Pep Guardiola would know, in the week leading up to a derby game, don't say something like, this game is more important than the Manchester United game, because it just isn't. I know what he means in terms of the context of the next game being the most important game. And like he said in that clip, 28 games left and there's only six or three left in the Champions League and two now, just exactly like he said. I understand his point, but it's not more important than the Manchester United game. It just isn't. It can't be. Not for Manchester City fans, surely. So I can understand why City fans are starting to get a bit annoyed with some of the things that Pep has been saying. Because I said this on yesterday's podcast as well. He even got into a bit of a tiff with the official supporters club a few weeks ago. You know, listen, they love him, they adore him, but I just think some of the things he says, he doesn't help himself. And then he comes out and says, oh, you're taking the piss out of me because I said this. Well, don't say it then. That's kind of my takeaway at times from Pep Guardiola. I appreciate his passion and I understand what he's saying entirely. And I do think his point's been taken out of context. But he could have saved himself a whole lot of stress if he just didn't say it.
He opens himself up to this. He has a tendency, it's always this stage of the season, or sometimes a little bit later in the season, he just gets really agitated, really spiky, like sort of gets a bit personal with journalists, acts a bit kind of offended by everything. And that whole, you just played a clip of it there, that whole press conference after that rant, he just gave kind of one and two word answers. What did that goal do for Sterling's confidence? Don't know, you'd have to ask him. Just a lot of that. And I think he's clearly feeling the pressure. I think City fans are used to the idea that he's a little bit disconnected from the kind of what we think of as the most important thing for the club. And I think genuinely he views the United game as like Barcelona playing Espanyol. I don't think he sees it in the same way as he sees a Liverpool game or a Champions League game. And I also think, we've dropped points already in this group to Paris. We've got Paris at the end of this month. I think that's the next game. I think he'd really like to not have to go into that game needing to win, just because that then puts all the pressure on that. So I can kind of see where he's coming from. I also think, having listened to that full press conference, which I don't often do, some of the journalists just kind of asking the same question again and again and again, like they're poking the bear. And to some extent, he's given them that reaction, right? And I do understand that he should learn now not to do that. But equally, just find something more intelligent to ask him. Do you know what I mean? Rather than ranking the importance of various games, like talk about the tactics or talk about how good Bruges were. Just, I don't know. Just, you know, change tune at some point.
Yeah, I know what you're saying. And actually, it's interesting because I think in his post-match interview with BT Sport, just to kind of continue on this thread, and I know we're not talking specifically about the game, but City were good value for the 4-1 win, so we can leave that to one side for now. But in the post-match interview on BT Sport, I think it was, he hinted at Manchester City not getting help, to paraphrase, unlike other big clubs, was what he was insinuating. Is that what you think he was referring to, Callum, or were you not so sure what he was hinting at there?
Genuinely no idea. That whole bit was kind of quite incomprehensible to me. And I think, again, I'm wary of criticising too much because I think sometimes his English can be a little bit hard to decipher. I wouldn't be surprised if he's not very happy still about the decisions in the Crystal Palace game and the red cards. And I genuinely would not be surprised.
The most important game is the next one, but I'm still angry about last week.
Just been stewing about that just all week. So yeah, to be honest, I don't know. I don't really know. And I think he obviously compares himself. For all this talk about how, oh, we're just focused on our next game and blah, 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 he also constantly talks about Jurgen Klopp and Thomas Tuchel and the rest of them that he clearly sees himself alongside and compares what they get to what City get. And I think, yeah, I don't know. He's obviously seen some kind of decision and he knows he can't talk about it explicitly, so he's just sort of speaking in these riddles, but it was a bit beyond me.
Yeah, Marley's right, though. He hasn't changed in 5 years, and I don't think he will, obviously. And it does make for good entertainment, and it makes for good talking points on the podcast as well. Just finally, then, before we move on, it's the derby this weekend, as we've said. Do you go into that game off the back of this result, Callum, with confidence or anxiety, or naturally because it's a derby game, there's going to be a bit of both?
A bit of both, I think. This United team, like we've said, are so hard to predict. Like, I would actually be feeling more comfortable if they were just on fire and it was just going to be like a kind of more like a Liverpool game where both teams are brilliant. But I think United could either implode and it could be another sort of 5-0, 6-1 type thing. But equally, they've got some very good players. They don't seem to have a system or any kind of tactics or any kind of coherence as a team. But sometimes they get through games because they've got like a couple of the best players in the world who just turn it on. And yeah, I always think back to that game where we could have won the title at the Etihad and United beat us 3-2 and Paul Pogba had an absolutely incredible game, having been totally rubbish for two seasons around it. And yeah, I'm always anxious about it. But I think in many ways, there's never been a better time to play United. But that's exactly the kind of time that City would lose to them.
I totally agree with you as well. It wouldn't be a surprise if Manchester United lost handsomely to Man City, but it also equally wouldn't be a surprise with the players they've got that they went and beat Manchester City. It's such a fascinating game. Looking forward to previewing that game as well on this weekend's edition of The Dugout, which you can find right here on this feed here from Football Social Daily, featuring former Premier League professionals Trevor Stephen and Matt Jarvis, who'll be joining me. So hit subscribe and that way you won't miss another episode. We're going to be talking about Newcastle next on Football Social Daily. We'll do it after this.
Football Social Daily. Subscribe to the podcast now so you never miss an episode. Football Social Daily. Find more great sport at sport-social.co.uk.
Welcome back. This is Football Social Daily from Sport Social, and Newcastle United are on the agenda now, much to the delight of Marley Anderson, who's joining me along with Callum Tyler. They're still managerless, though, the Toon. They haven't replaced Steve Bruce. And the latest news coming out of St James's Park this week is that Villarreal manager Unai Emery has rejected the club's approach to become their new boss. He says he's remaining 100% committed to the project he's got there in Spain. The local press were allegedly briefed that Emery was going to be the new boss. The plug has basically been pulled on that. What's your take here, Marley? Because what, Steve Bruce been sacked now for a couple of weeks? Is it becoming a bit of a shambles? What's your opinion as a fan?
Shambles isn't too far off right now. The names have been going round, you know. Plenty of names have been going round. Conte at first, and you know, Zidane and all these like huge ridiculous names that we were never really going to get. Then it sort of settled down into Fonseca. There was talks with Fonseca. Then it quickly moved to Unai Emery, and that was as close as it's been. But it always worried me that all this speculation about him being in for the weekend, like in charge for the weekend against Brighton, it always was weird to me that was all coming out on a Tuesday when Villarreal were playing that night. And I just thought, this is strange timing. Usually, like, Villarreal play on Tuesday night and then in the Champions League, and then the rumours have come out on Wednesday or something like that. But it's just yeah, it was strange. And then obviously he comes out with this statement that he's staying. Wasn't really massively surprised, because I was wondering why you'd leave Villarreal to come to Newcastle. Although I had kind of convinced myself that he feels like he'd hit a ceiling with Villarreal, and maybe that's why he fancied the challenge of Newcastle. But obviously it didn't work out like that. He's gone and we're back to square one now, and almost square one. And square one is basically Eddie Howe, who's always been available, has been for the last 2 years. Should have got the job probably the day the new owners came in, because now he's got that situation where it's almost like Nuno at Spurs in the summer. Like, you know, you were never first choice for the job, and so do the players, which is not the best sort of start to things from the consortium's point of view that have bought us, because they've came in, there's no director of football, there's no manager, there's still people involved from Bruce and Ashley's spell in time in charge.
Keeping quiet, not meeting anyone.
yeah.
Sticking away from everyone.
We've still got all the Steves as the first team coaches, Steve Agnew and Steve Clements and Steve Harper. They're all there. And Lee Charnley's still there trying to do deals. And the one thing Lee Charnley did for Mike Ashley was prove to everyone that he's not a football negotiator. He doesn't really know how to do it. So it's a bit of a mess.
You mentioned Charnley's not a football negotiator, which is a fair enough comment to make. But are the new ownership football people? Has Amanda Staveley, have the Rubin brothers, have they ever been involved in football before? I don't know much of their background, to be perfectly honest. Maybe you can shed some more light if you know that information. But is it a case of they've gone into a Premier League club, which is effectively an organisation, because that's what Premier League clubs are these days, and maybe they've not bitten off more than they can chew? I think that's the wrong terminology to use, but certainly found it more difficult water to wade through than they first anticipated.
Yeah, I think that's one of the things. Like, it is businessmen and millionaires that are involved in this deal. There's not too many that are football people, as you'd describe, you know, have advisors and things like that. And we're kind of looking at them to guide us through, but who are the advisors? Like, nobody really knows. So it's not perfect. I feel like they're sort of relying on the money to get them through things. And I think if you believe what's coming out about Emery, the rumour is that he said they lack a clear plan. And I think that's because the takeover took that long that they probably had plans in place. And then when it got rejected, those plans fell apart a little bit and targets went elsewhere. And then finally, when the takeover went through really quickly, all of a sudden, like, we were meant to go to court and everything like that, the takeover then got, like, the court case got dropped and the takeover just went through like 0 to 100 real quick. And then everyone was like, well, it wouldn't surprise me if everyone was like, oh, Jesus Christ, we had a plan, now we don't have a plan, now we're in the seats now, we're taking over, we've got a, you know, we've got to sack Bruce. When do we sack Bruce? Well, we'll sack him straight away. Oh, no, we won't.
Is that because it happened so quick, with the piracy thing getting sorted out almost
probably
rapidly? You know, it was on the back burner, wasn't it, this takeover, for ages? And there was meant to be an arbitration hearing in January, wasn't there? Which is still 2 months from now, about the outcome of this case with the Premier League. And then all of a sudden, one weekend, oh, the Saudis and the Qataris have sorted out their issues over piracy. And that paved the way to give the takeover the green light. And all of a sudden it's, oh my God, it's happening. And do you think that it might be what it is? It's kind of caught them on the hop a little bit.
Yeah, probably. There's probably some reasoning to that, some logic behind that. So yeah, it probably has caught them out a little bit. But then again, you know, you could say they've had 2 years or more to plan for this situation. So should you have been ready the whole time? Should you have known that the minute you get in, you're giving Bruce his P45 and giving it to Eddie Howe to the end of the season? Or are you giving it to, have you got a manager almost on retainer from this sort of situation playing out? Because for me, if they'd had everything sorted out and if they'd known this thing was going through in October, there is no way they wouldn't have went to Rafa Benitez in the summer and said, don't take the Everton job. We're 3 months away from being in charge. Because that's exactly the logic you should have had. But they didn't know. They thought this is going to go on probably till next summer at least, or at least February or January, whenever this arbitration case was. So they're probably thinking, well, there's no point in talking to Rafa because the deal's dead in the water right now. It might resurrect, but we can't go to him and say, give us 6 more months, give us another year, because it's not fair on him. Like, the guy's got to work.
It does make me laugh that you are a Newcastle fan first and foremost, but your second team this season is just whoever's playing Everton.
Do you know, well, if I think I said on the podcast just before the takeover went through, I'd almost consider supporting Everton if Bruce carried on at my club, because basically Everton had everything I wanted at Newcastle, which was Benitez, Rondon, even though he's a couple of years later, Townsend was there, who we should have bought 4 years ago. So it was almost like Everton were Newcastle Light or Newcastle 2.0 or something like that. So
Newcastle Beta, yeah.
Yeah. So,
I mean, Marley, we know your opinion on the Steve Bruce situation. So I'll ask Callum. Do you think sacking Steve Bruce with no replacement in the picture was a wise move or not? Surely they have to get a new manager in before this weekend is done, because it's international break after that. And so they've got a 2-week window where, if there is a new manager to come in, that's the time they need to bed in.
They've put themselves under tremendous pressure by sacking Bruce, haven't they? Like, if they could have just held him there until they found someone else. And also, I know that, you know, managerial prospects are a bit thin on the ground right now, but I would say wait till the January transfer window in February, when loads of managers will be kind of moving around, resigning, out of work. Like, you might have a lot more options. So there might be a big casualty kind of next year that wants to go straight back into a job. I think yeah, they've done it in a way that has put maximum pressure on themselves. And also, I do you know what I think it was? I think it was the temptation. They want to be seen to be doing something straight away. We've got to do something straight away. Sack the manager. What's next? Like, you know, they couldn't. It would have been such a anti-climax. I think they would have imagined it being such an anti-climax if they come in and just not done anything, and kept Bruce in and fan, you know. The fans would be getting a bit annoyed by this at this point, and the results probably wouldn't have changed, but the results haven't changed either. And you are actually looking now at a situation where they might have Newcastle in a relegation fight till the end of the season. Is Howe the right manager for that job? Do you now need to go and get an Allardyce type figure, like someone to get you out of this hole and then sack him in the summer? It's just, yeah, it's an odd one. And I don't think, to your previous point, I don't think they are football people. I don't think they're quite attuned to the sort of how important it is to stay in the Premier League at this stage and who can keep you there. Because I actually wouldn't really necessarily back how to do that. I think they need someone to kind of galvanise them a little bit. And you know, where are those managers? Who do you go, yeah, do you go and get?
So, yeah, in terms of credible options, I think we've spoken about Fonseca on the podcast. We've spoken about Unai Emery today. We've spoken about Eddie Howe in the past. I think Lucien Favre was another name that was linked, plus all of those Hollywood names that Marley listed as well before now. Is it Eddie Howe in terms of he's the only real manager out there that fits the criteria in terms of understanding the Premier League, fits the criteria in terms of is out of work, fits the criteria in terms of isn't going to be someone who maybe demands more than is on offer right now, if that makes sense. He's again in the picture. A lot of people consider him, Marley, as the man who took Bournemouth down rather than the man who got Bournemouth from League Two to the Premier League. So in terms of a relegation fight, which is what Newcastle are in right now, let's be frank, is he the right man for that job?
Well, he's been in it before, and I don't know. I don't know who's right for us right now, because, you know, if you bring in a specialist who's used to fighting with clubs, you are looking at one of those idiot managers who you just got rid of, like Allardyce and all these sort of teams, all these sort of managers that come in and manage teams for 6 months and bugger off in the summer. So that's not right for long term or longer term appointments. So for me, Eddie Howe plays, I mean, I've been saying this for about a year now, I would take Eddie Howe at Newcastle in a heartbeat. I think his style of football is fantastic. Is it suitable for a relegation fight? I'm not really sure. However, he did keep Bournemouth up for 4 years when they were probably favourites to go down, playing that type of football. So yes, it went wrong in the fifth year, but Bournemouth were always probably the smallest club on paper in the league in that point. They had a 12 or 14,000 seater stadium, not that much money coming into the club. They were owned by, you know,
Maxim Demin, he's a Russian fella. So he did have a few quid actually at Bournemouth. I don't like people saying plucky Bournemouth that have no money, because they got loads of it and they spent a lot of it as well.
No, exactly. But
certainly I think that, you know, in terms of working with players like Callum Wilson, Ryan Fraser, Alan Saint-Maximin playing in an Eddie Howe style would be quite nice to watch as well.
It's interesting though, because like Celtic were chasing Eddie Howe for about 3 months and they eventually turned him down because they didn't have a vision and he didn't believe that they had a plan. Surely he's not going to rock up and think the Saudis have a plan and a vision.
Well,
like,
apparently he interviewed for the job this week, or maybe to the end of last week, and he apparently presented an incredibly detailed plan of what he would do with the squad and what he wanted to do in January. So I feel like Eddie Howe's been waiting for this job for at least a year now. I think that's one of the big reasons why he didn't end up at Celtic, because Celtic is a good job and it's relatively easy to get, you know, to do what Celtic want to do. They want to be challenging for the title. That's fairly easy. And it's them against Rangers every year because they've got the biggest budgets in the league and what have you. And then do what you can in Europe. There's not that much pressure on you to go and succeed in Europe, for example. But I think he always knew Bruce was going to get sacked. He was a dead man walking for a long time. So I think Eddie Howe has kept himself free. I don't for a minute believe he's had no offers. So it's not like nobody wants him and no one's looking at him. I think he's just thought that Newcastle job is perfect for me. I've got, you know, the infrastructure will be there by the time he gets the opportunity to take the job, because it was always only going to come to him when the takeover went through. There's money there to spend. There's a good base to work with. The squad, yes, needs work, but he has worked with a couple of them before, as we mentioned, Wilson and Fraser. He's been around the Premier League. He knows the rest of the squad. So I don't think it's a bad appointment at all. It's just one of those things where what is the situation going to be when everybody knows that you weren't first choice? Because sometimes that gets you off on the wrong foot. However, having looked at there's a clip going viral now of his training sessions, how technical and how detailed they are. I think that'd be huge for our squad, because Steve Bruce used to just kick a ball in the middle of the grass and say, right, lads, let's play. And that is it. And there's even a quote from Richie Dalat, it was, who played for him under Villa, at Villa. And he literally said it was like an under nine session where he'd just kick a ball and say, right, lads, let's have a game. And that's great when you're an amateur, but that's awful when you're a professional. You want to know what to do in certain situations. So Eddie Howe would be, for me, a very good appointment. Yes, not quite Emery and not quite the names we've been linked with, Favre and all the rest of them, but still a much better than what you've had for the last 2.5 years. So crack on.
Newcastle is a long way from Dorset, though. So there we go. But I'm sure it's an opportunity that he'll certainly
be. Can he stand the cold up there? That sea breeze coming in.
Eddie Howe is certainly on the shortlist, you have to suggest, for Newcastle. When will they appoint a new manager? We'll have to wait and see, of course. When we find out information about that, we'll let you know on the podcast and, of course, on the website as well, sport-social.co.uk. Right, European action for other Premier League clubs taking place as well tonight. We've already talked about the Champions League. We'll talk about the Europa League and the Europa Conference next here on Football Social Daily.
Football Social Daily. Find more great sport at sport-social.co.uk. Football Social Daily. Subscribe to the podcast now so you never miss an episode.
Welcome back to the final part of the show. Time to talk about the European action tonight for West Ham, Leicester and Spurs. In terms of Leicester, they play at home tonight to Spartak Moscow. That's a big game in the context of their Europa League group. They're currently third and they're still yet to play Napoli. And they travel to Naples in the first week of December. But we won't talk about Leicester for now. We'll just focus on West Ham and Spurs for the time being. We'll start with the Hammers, who travel to Belgium to play Genk in what will be David Moyes' 1,000th game as a manager. How would you reflect on his career so far, Callum? Do you think he's someone who maybe gets a little bit of disrespect due to a couple of failures that he's had in his career, mainly at Manchester United and then at Real Sociedad?
Yeah, I think on the whole, his career has been a success. It's hard to weigh up, looking at 1,000 games, whether it's been a definitive success or a definitive failure. I think the United job was a bit unfortunate. I think probably looking back, he might have thought that it wasn't quite the right time to be so soon after Ferguson. But then Ferguson did kind of anoint him, didn't he, and said, this is the guy. So I think he will have been vindicated by the fact that nobody's really succeeded at United since he had a go. I think when you look at what he's done for Everton, the consistency that he brought to that team, and what he did like before Everton at the likes of Preston, and also what he's done at West Ham and the way he's managed to stabilise what was becoming a bit of a basket case of a club. And they're really difficult to beat. They've had some big wins this season. They've got to fancy themselves in Europe, certainly at this stage, before we know who's dropping in from the Champions League. But yeah, I think within the game, Moyes is really well respected. I think people know what he's about. And I think it's one of those classic things where he's kind of got a bit of a look about him, and he's kind of a bit dour, and he's kind of not, you know, he's not the sort of sexy Jurgen Klopp or Pep Guardiola or one of those type managers. And so he gets a bit of grief and a bit of a joke made of him by sort of fans online and things. But I think within the game, people that know Moyes know that he's kind of the real deal, and he's a proper, you know, successful, impressive manager. And you can tell at the moment how much those players at West Ham are enjoying their football and how much they love playing for him.
Yeah, absolutely. Congratulations to Moyes for his 1,000th game. Obviously, in the context of the Europa League, Hammers will qualify to the next stage with a win or even a draw, really, considering they've won their three games up to this point so far. If you qualify as group winner in the Europa League this season, you avoid those Champions League teams dropping out, which, of course, is an incentive to teams in the competition from the beginning. How much of a threat are they, do you think, from what we've seen so far, Marley, and from what we've seen so far this season from them, not just in the Premier League, but also in Europe? Do you think that they do have the quality to go the distance, or at least go deep into the Europa League this season?
I think they've got enough to go deep into it. Yeah, I think they're managing really well at the minute. You know, they're winning games they're meant to win. As I said a couple of podcasts ago, I can't remember the last time West Ham won games you expected them to win. You always expect them to capitulate for some reason, for some unknown reason that goes against everything you think you know about them. But yeah, they do look strong at the minute. You know, they're playing well against top sides as well. They look hard to beat and a threat when they get the ball. So I don't see why they can't get to at least the quarters or the semis. And then you're looking at them, obviously it all depends on the draw and what might happen when that happens. But you are looking at them saying, I don't think anybody will underestimate them anymore. Like, I think if West Ham were in this last season, you'd be like, well, they're a bit of an unknown quantity, but people are starting to look at them now and say they're really, really good from set pieces. They've got, you know, talented midfield, the front of that midfield three, the wingers and the attacking midfielder, they're all very creative. They've got a striker up front who, as long as he stays fit, Antonio is a handful for any defender. If they bring in another striker in January, which I still think they need, they could be even more of a threat. So fair play to West Ham. They're absolutely smashing it at the minute. You know, they've made easy work of this group. They're already through, and it's now just about who they get in the last 16 or whatever it is in the Europa League. So not many teams will be looking at them going, would love to play them, because they're an easy draw. There's going to be way easier teams that make it through into this Europa League knockout stage that teams would fancy more than them.
Yeah, 100%. West Ham travel to Belgium tonight to play Genk, expecting them to get the job done like they did in the reverse fixture of this one. Leicester, as we said already, will play Spartak Moscow. But let's look at Tottenham Hotspur, who welcome Vitesse Arnhem, the Dutch side, to the Tottenham Hotspur Stadium in the UEFA Europa Conference League tonight. Now, Antonio Conte was appointed as the new manager of Tottenham earlier this week. Reports claim, though, that he's still getting permits and documentation sorted and finalised, so he might not actually be in the dugout, but he is in situ. He's the new manager. Do you think we'll see a change of formation and maybe a change of form, Callum, for Tottenham, even if he isn't there in person?
It's quite hard to say, actually, isn't it? Because they would probably rotate for this game anyway. I think there's quite a few players in that Spurs team that should be pretty worried now that a manager the likes of Conte is coming in. I think there's a few of them that are maybe going to be sitting a few games out. Yeah, I think it's quite hard to predict what kind of team he'll put out. I think they need to change it up anyway. They probably would rest players tonight. Vitesse, Arnhem, of course, are the Chelsea feeder club, so it's kind of actually going to be even more embarrassing than usual if Spurs don't beat them, even though that, you know, it's the Europa Conference League, but it's basically Chelsea's youth team that they're playing. So yeah, it'll be an interesting one. I mean, we won't really know anything about Conte until his first league game where he's actually in the dugout. But it adds a layer of interest to this for sure.
Yeah, 100%. I think that Antonio Conte will probably have already met some of the players, if not in person, then via video link and with coaching staff as well. I'm not quite sure what's going on there. He's been given an 18-month deal, of course. Do you think this game, though, will be a bit of an indication, Marley, for the new manager from the very beginning as to which players are up for the fight and which players aren't? Because we've heard in interviews that he doesn't suffer fools gladly, does he?
Yeah, heaven help the first person that doesn't quite show up and give their all in tonight's game, because they're going to be, well, almost like a lamb to the slaughter if that's the case. Because, as we know, you know, Conte's going to come in, he's going to be like a grenade on the touchline, bouncing around, shouting at everyone, absolutely giving everyone pelters if they don't track back or put their foot in and win a ball that they should have won. So he's going to be box office, which is brilliant for a neutral, because you're always looking at Conte going, how's he not had just a heart attack every game? Because his blood pressure and his heart rate must be in the, you know, the high 160s like at all times. Madness.
You know what they say about stress? It makes you lose your hair, and he's already had one hair transplant. So
oh yeah, the smart money's on next summer, Antonio Conte being booked into a hair transplant clinic in Switzerland, getting another hair transplant after he's done with Spurs. So it'd be interesting tonight, though. I think Spurs will definitely win. That new manager bounce, as we always talk about, is something that we'll see them through. They haven't got the hardest opposition either, have they? Let's be honest. It's not the hardest game in the world. But yeah, we'll see. It's at home. You couldn't ask for a better game, really, to kick off your spell than Vitesse at home. You know, under the lights, brand new stadium and everything like that. A new sort of dawn, a new era for Spurs. You know, they probably have a lot more fans in there than they would have had it been Nuno for another week. So we'll see. We'll see. Probably see them in that back. Apparently, they were training in the back 3/5 system on his first training session, so probably see that again as we've got used to from him being at Chelsea and Inter, and we'll see what Spurs can do with it. But I think they're suited to it, and I think Vitesse are lambs to the slaughter tonight, to be fair.
Yeah, I think that we'll see some sort of reaction from Tottenham, as you say, whether that's due to the influence of Conte, whether it's just that new manager bounce, I'm not so sure, but I think we will see one. Spurs need the points anyway in this group. They're currently third after they lost to Vitesse last time around. That's it for today's Football Social Daily. Thank you very much, Marley. I'll let you go off and do some research into who you think will be the best next Newcastle manager.
Yeah, I'm knocking up a PowerPoint presentation to suggest why I should be given the job until at least the summer.
Well, you can't be any worse than some of the PowerPoint presentations going on at COP26 that Callum's probably had to witness on his local news station.
Yeah, just staying away from Glasgow for the time being.
Probably for the better. Thanks for your time listening to the show. Don't forget, if you hit subscribe, that way you won't miss another episode of the podcast again. Brand new shows every single day of the Premier League season. But that's it for today's Football Social Daily, and we'll speak to you again tomorrow.
Football Social Daily. Find more great sport at sport-social.co.uk.
Hello, it is Ryan, and we could all use an extra bright spot in our day, couldn't we? Just to make up for things like sitting in traffic, doing the dishes, counting your steps, you know, all the mundane stuff. That is why I'm such a big fan of Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has all your favorite social casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere with daily bonuses. That should brighten your day a little. Actually, a lot. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com. That's chumbacasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18+.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to... Has anyone seen the bride and groom?
Sorry, sorry, we're here. We were getting lucky in the limo and we lost track of time.
No, Lucky Land Casino. With cash prizes that add up quicker than a guest registry.
In that case, I pronounce you lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Daily bonuses are waiting. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.